Excuse me, I'm sorry. Transmitting pictures. I don't think, again, that there needs to be a special dial-net protocol for it, because a picture is just to be regarded as a collection of bits. There will want to be at some time, higher, as there have been with the ARPANET, higher level protocols built on the lower level protocols. In other words, it's one answer to the question is that, well, a picture is just a string of bits that you can send like any other string of bits. But on the other hand, that if some group of people wish to transmit pictures, then they again have to make up protocols as to how a picture is represented by a string of bits. Now, I should say this, that we ourselves have asked the Science Foundation for a rather small amount of money, enough for 1.5 people for 1.5 years. We are trying to cut it down to the minimum we can to make the system so that it will be useful. Because we didn't think they'd give us more. I should say, by the way, that when we first asked them for the money, to first start talking about it, one of the officials said to us, well, we'll have to ask the Office of Telecommunications Policy about this. That was in the office in the White House. But fortunately, the Office of Telecommunications Policy has been abolished. any other question? Yes? Okay, since the phone company establishes only point-to-point connections, how can you have several connections between two hosts? Is that it? Simultaneous connections between two hosts? Since the communications capacity of a telephone line is not very great, we are currently thinking about implementing only a single connection so that a system that wished to be able to support several dial net activities simultaneously might have to implement to get several telephone dialers and connections. This is a problem that can be examined. One can look at it and say, is it possibly feasible to do what the ARPANET does, which is to implement it in such a way that you can have several things operating at the same time. I'm just not sure how that's going to turn out. Yes?
You say you have speed out of the network that you propose to do something like the data computer concept where you might replace or provide archive of storage with your network.
Okay. The question was, is this reasonable for implementing something like the data computer concept where you provide archival storage over the network? My opinion is that it is not adequate for a national type archival storage, but it might very well be adequate for a local type. In other words, if one of these enterprising businessmen, of which there are a large number out here, were to implement a service where he operates an inexpensive to him disk file or a large scale disk file, and says that he will store files for you for a price, and you can retrieve them whenever you like, it seems to me that that would be a quite feasible business in a local telephone area, which means the Bay Area, because, for example, you can get this service from the telephone company where, if you choose specific locations in the Bay Area, it counts as a local call. You pay them extra per month. By the way, one could say that this dial-net could, in some of its manifestations, just as especially the login application, make the telephone company even more inclined to pursue the idea that they ought to get more money for very long connections. Okay. It's been suggested that I take two more questions. But there aren't two more questions.
Our next speaker is Ray Panko. Ray is working presently at Stanford Research Institute, doing work on computer mail, electronic mail, and office automation. He is about to leave the pleasant climate of the Bay Area and depart for the rigors of Hawaii. Ray Panko?
Is there a light switch in here? Could you turn it back on, Bob? Bob, if you're going to be here through the lecture, you'll be my light man. If not, we'll work something else out. Before I start, I'd like to ask a couple questions. First, how many people here do programming on an ARPANET computer? Can I see a show of hands? Well, that's pretty high. Are there any officials here from ARPA or the Defense Communication Agency? If not, I think I can talk a bit more freely. I'm going to be talking about sort of a weird idea called CB computer mail, which is not means doing computer mail over citizen band radio channels, as I've since found out a lot of people are thinking of doing. What I want to do is give a fair amount of background information about the whole subject of message communication. I want to start out first by talking about electronic mail to bring some perspective to the whole thing, because electronic mail is here. It's been here for about 50 years, and it's a very large industry that's fairly mature. So when we talk about computer mail, which is the second part of my talk, we're really talking about a perturbation on the system, and I think that's fairly important. And then finally, I'll get into the area of trying to talk about how computer hobbyists might want to do computer mail. Now, we have quite a few seats over to the right and in the center, and if people would like to take a couple minutes to sit down, I'll just hold the talk for a couple minutes. I'd like to ask another question while people are settling in. How many people in the audience actually own a hobby computer? That's a fair number. How many other people share hobby computers? Okay. How many people do not either own a hobby computer or share a hobby computer? So about 75% of you own a hobby computer and 75% don't own a hobby computer. Is a microphone on? Okay, I think people are settled in, so I can start talking a little bit. First of all, on the general topic of electronic mail, in the past 3 or 4 years, people have been talking about an exciting new phenomenon called electronic mail, and they've been talking about facsimile, communicating word processing, typewriters, and stuff like that. And I heard one person say this is going to be a billion-dollar-a-year industry fairly soon, which started me wondering, what is this guy talking about? It is a billion-dollar-a-year industry. And I'll go down and I'll talk about some of the services that have traditionally been offered. Now, there is, of course, the public telegram system, which is a joke, but brings in $100 million in revenue each year to Western Union. It's going down, but it's still there. But nobody cares about its demise because people have plenty of ways of communicating electronically. There's also telex and Twix. Now, telex and Twix are both Western Union services. Twix used to be an AT&T service, but they were forced to spin it off, and they won't be able to jump back into it until next year. Now, the idea of telex and Twix, if you've ever operated one of these barbarities or had something sent over them, is you pay for very low-speed communication costs that really, really cost a lot of money. Cost over $1 per message on the average. So what you do, you get this humongous terminal, and you type your message onto paper tape. Then you rip off the paper tape, you put it into a reader, and you dial up the other thing, and then you send it over the network as fast as you can. And of course, this is a wonderful thing. Nobody likes to do it. So each company has their own teletypewriter priesthood in order to handle this telex and Twix machine. Now, the average telex or Twix message costs just about $2, somewhere between $2 and $2.25 on the average. And one would assume that with that high price and all the difficulties in communicating that there wouldn't be very many telex and twix messages sent. And there aren't. There are only about 100 million, which is about $250 million a year in revenue. Now, that's fairly small, though, because if you're going to be a private company like General Motors, you're not going to rent a telex and twix terminal. You're going to build your own computer, well, not computer network, but teletypewriter network within your corporation. These things are called private wire networks. And nobody knows exactly how many of these there are. It's not something that's been well studied. But it seems that total revenues for private teletypewriter networks are somewhere between $500 million a year and $1.5 billion a year right now. I think it's probably about $1 billion a year. Now, this means that there are probably, depending on who you believe on price, somewhere between 1 and 4 billion messages a year going over these private wire networks and corporations. It's a big business. Now, before 1970, there was something called facsimile, but it wasn't really very good. Because if you wanted to send facsimile messages, you had to deal with, first of all, the machine. Now, until about 1970, facsimile really lagged behind in the introduction of solid-state devices. So the machines were large, messy, smelly, had poor quality, and were quite expensive to run because they took about 6 minutes to send anything over a telephone. There were some other problems. It was very difficult in terms of legal restrictions to hook up a facsimile unit to the telephone network. That finally got struck down somewhere around 1970, depending on what you believe happened with various court cases. And about 1970, things started to change, and the facsimile manufacturers, instead of being laggards in solid state, suddenly started picking it up and started producing some fairly good units. Now, facsimile has been growing very rapidly and has been getting a lot of attention. And it looks like there are somewhere between 100,000 and 300,000 facsimile terminals in the United States, again, depending on who you believe. There are just about 110,000 telex and twix units. So in the space of maybe 3 or 4 years, facsimile has come up and is already surpassing telex and twix. But you really have to compare it with private wire networks because that's how facsimile is used. It tends to be used mostly within corporations. And it's a long way from passing it, despite some statements to the contrary. And I suspect that it'll be 1980 or 1990 before it really starts being important as a very large chunk of the internal message services in corporations. Now, there are some new things that are happening. One of them is communicating word processing typewriters. And we've had word processing units around since about 1964. When IBM came out with their MTST. But about 3 or 4 years ago, some people got the idea, well, gee, we've got these things. We're preparing all these long documents. Why don't we put a communication module on these and send these documents back and forth? And about 2 or 3 years ago, people started doing this. And these things are called communicating word processing typewriters, and they're exploding. There are about 25,000 of these right now in the United States, and they're growing very rapidly. This means that there are already a quarter as many as there are telex and twix units. And so this thing looks like another thing that's picking up. Also, if you have one communicating word processing typewriter, you can take the output from other word processing typewriters in your organization and play it out. So probably there are between 100 and 500,000 word processing typewriters that are connected with one another in one sense or another. Now, communicating word processing typewriters are a new phenomenon. They're very difficult to talk about because they're expensive. The communication module tends to rent for between $60 and $100 a month, which is a good deal more than a telex or than a facsimile unit. But the advantage of these things are that if you've prepared a long document on it, you can transmit it across country at a fairly high speed, unless of course you have IBM products, and get it across at fairly low price to another unit. I don't know what IBM's doing. I think they're anticipating their System 6, which is pretty good in that respect. But their standard automatic typewriter is lousy. Now, I think that communicating word processors are going to be in the large document niche. If you're just going to be sending messages over it, and you wouldn't be using this fairly expensive tool to be preparing your messages on, it's somewhat expensive. Now, there are other things coming up. One of them is just using an intelligent terminal and taking that telex or twix unit. Instead of doing it on paper tape, have some local intelligence so you can type up your message interactively, dial up the other number automatically, and then send it across back and forth. And the cost of these tends to be somewhat lower, but not drastically so, than other types of services I've been discussing. Now, the problems with these things is that they're all fairly expensive to use. They cost somewhere between 50 cents and $2.50 a message. That doesn't kill you, because the average cost of producing a message is somewhere between $5 and $10 by the time you add the people cost, but it's still fairly expensive. As a matter of fact, people really haven't been doing time and motion studies, but I suspect that a lot of these forms of electronic mail add substantially to the labor costs that they're supposed to be reducing, particularly if you don't have a facsimile unit right in your office, if you have to go way down the hall, sit there and wait while the thing transmits, and so on. They also don't do much. Most of these systems don't aid you at all in composition, and after they deliver it to the other end, they sort of forget about it. So if you've got a telex or Twix terminal, you're storing things on dingy little scraps of paper that roll up and are nasty to put into filing cabinets, and when you make copies of them, the copies don't look very good. And so there are some problems with all these units. They don't do file retrieval. After they deliver the message, you can't go back in and say, gee, Joe Doak sent me a message last week, I'd sure like to get that back, because if you want it back, you're going to have to go through your own files. Probably the worst thing about them is that they have this teletypewriter priesthood, or in some companies, facsimile priesthoods, that separate the user from the system, and people, as a result, don't know where they are. You have the out-of-sight, out-of-mind phenomenon, and it's almost as if you took all the telephones in a corporation and put them in a single room, and then when you want to call someone, you'd call up their telephone number, someone would take the message, deliver it, the message would be delivered back to the telephone room, and it would be sent out. Now, how you can get a $1 billion-a-year industry out of this somewhat amazes me, but it does seem to be happening. Now, I've said that something like 100 to 400 billion messages a year, I'm sorry, 1 to 4 billion messages a year probably flow in the United States. And could I have the first view file, table one? Makes about as much sense. Bob, could you turn the lights on? Now, this is for a study we're currently doing for Bell Canada, and we're trying to figure out what really are the information flows in the United States and Canada, and we're trying to take a look at how many sheets of paper flow around. And all these figures are in billions of pages, and if you add them up, you have something like 600 billion pages flowing through the U.S. economy and Canadian economies each year. And as you can see, most of this is within organizations, between offices, and more importantly, within offices. Now, the within offices we've labeled as a rough estimate, and it is fairly rough. I suspect it may be a lot larger, but since we've never had a communication medium for intra-office communication, we've never really worried about that, and we haven't studied it. The forms number, I'm told, is somewhat low, and this is growing very rapidly. By 1980, it'll be about 50% higher than it is now. Thanks to U.S. government regulations and a lot of things that industry is doing themselves, forms are growing very rapidly. So one would expect that if you took a look at an electronic mail system within a corporation, oh, that's something like 50 to 75% of all material flowing over it would consist of forms. And fortunately, that's correct. Most of these things are used to process forms. So a lot of companies are starting to put online systems for sending forms and to send them as data, and I'll be talking about that a little bit later. Now, this is written communication flows. What if you had an electronic mail system that was so simple to use you could simply knock out a message to a friend on the other side of the country and, you know, just do something informal, like instead of calling them up to give them a piece of information, you just drop it into their mailbox. Or suppose you worked within an organization, you're working at night and you want to leave your boss a message. You'd like to be able to just send messages to them. So these are things that we haven't been able to do with electronic mail, and so we've, in a sense, not even scratched the surface of written communication. Dave, could you put on the next one? Now, written communication is nice, but it only seems to take up about 25% of the day of a typical manager. Managers tend to spend about 80% of their day communicating in just about every time and motion study I've ever seen. Face-to-face meetings are about 50%, telephone 5 to 10%. it comes like 60% of the day just talking to people. Now, one might ask when people get their work done, if they spend this much time talking, you know, one hopes that interactive conversations really do produce new knowledge. The number goes down when you consider other office workers, but even chemists, who are the guys who are supposed to be these white-smocked people working in their laboratories, spend half their day communicating, 25% of it reading and writing, 25% of it face-to-face or on the telephone. So if you can have an electronic mail system that can substitute for voice messages, then you're talking about a potentially very large market. Okay, can I have the lights back on now? Now, there is an electronic communication medium that seems to be developing that will have some characteristics that make it a candidate for being very much larger. And this is called computer mail. Now, right from the start, timeshared computers have had mailbox services where if you had a PhD in computer science, you could send a message from one person to another. And it's very easy. You just mumble several magic incantations and it gets delivered. Now, the first of these came on CTSS, a compatible timesharing system at Project Mac, which is often called the first timesharing system. And that system set two precedents which have held until today. The first is that if you're really knowledgeable, you could send the message from one person and the other. The second precedent, which has been more important historically, is that they claim that you could do anything with their message system. That has been rigorously adhered to. Now, most of these things were pretty nasty, and people really didn't like to use them. But about 1972, the ARPANET became operational. Now, you have to understand the sociology of ARPA contractors. During the 1960s, these guys were rich. I mean, they had more travel money than you could ever believe. And they would go from conference to conference. But they always stayed funded by ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, because they had all the money and they were funding all the good AI stuff and, gee, all that neat stuff. So they tended to switch jobs with incredible regularity, but they always stayed with ARPA. And they went to meetings and they really knew one another. There was a community there. So in 1972, when the ARPANET finally got put together, one would expect that the people would modify their internal mailbox software to start sending things over the network. And indeed, they did. As a matter of fact, the network really became operational late in 72 before they got the file transfer protocols pinned down. And it was early 72 when both Brannick and Newman got one of their message systems working on the network. The first sending program was SendMessage, which is still in very general use. And the first reading program was called ReadMail. Now, SendMessage lets you type in a message or read a file in and send it in a fairly nice manner. And ReadMail lets you read your current mail and also look through your older mail that has come into you. Now, the sending process was fairly straightforward, and that was pretty stable. But people started finding they were getting 5, 10, 15, 20 messages a day in their inbox, and they just couldn't handle it with ReadMail. So people started producing more processing-intensive programs. And the first person to do this was Larry Roberts, who was then director of the Information Processing Technology, IPTO at ARPA. And he just couldn't hack it. So he wrote this in TECO macros, which is a black art in itself. But people started saying, gee, this stuff is cool. And they started doing better and better and better stuff. Now, some of these things were bootlegged onto other contracts. Some of them were done legitimately under other contracts. But people needed to talk. There was a big audience whenever a new development came. And these things got very sophisticated, very fast. And about 1974, when I first looked at this after looking at computer teleconferencing, I said, hey, this is really neat, because I started getting messages from all my friends at other parts of the country and within the organization. And I went to a buddy at ARPA and I says, hey, what does this cost per message? He took me aside and he says, look, I think it costs $60 a message. I said, there's no way this is going to cost $60 a message. So I started gathering all the cost data I could have. And in both systems, it appeared that the average message cost about $1.50. Hey, that wasn't bad. That was getting pretty close to what you're going to pay if you were doing communication over telex or twix or facsimile. And it makes sense because the transmission part over a packet switch network can't be more than 2 or 3 cents because the average message is only about 100 words And that's what, a couple or three packets? Well, I guess it's more than that, but it shouldn't cost you very much. And I started asking, well, what's this stuff going to look like in the future? And I got a very surprising answer. Dave, could you put the next one up? Now, I want to say that all this cost information is very tentative. We're just starting to get good cost data. Oh, could you put up the one after it instead of this one? It should have cost information. Yeah. Okay. Let's take a look at the top one, because I believe that more than I believe the bottom one. This is Planet, which, as you know, as some of you know, is a computer teleconferencing system, but it does have a message system. And I think that over half of all of its entries were really messages rather than conference items that went out to the group. Now, the actual cost for about 20,000 messages was $1.50 per message. And that seemed to be broken out about 50 cents each into the computer cost, the labor center at the computer, because about half the cost of running a computer center, and probably more, is labor, and another 50 cents for communication. And then we added about 20 cents for terminals, and that's really the most controversial thing to add in. And we said, what happens in 1977? Because this thing ran on a PDP-10 with a KA central processing unit, which is getting pretty obsolete, and said, what happens if you go to a KL? Well, using optimistic benchmarks that were lied to me by Dan Lynch, it looked like about a factor of 3 improvement for interactive processes. And I think it really is once they get some of the bugs out of their operating system. It could be a lot more than that, but a factor of 3 seemed to be in the ballpark. And I added things up, and instead of $1.70 a message under current architecture, I got 97 cents a message. And then I used an Arthur Doolittle study to project things out to 1985, and I got 56 cents a message. And gee, that's getting competitive. Now, notice that says current architecture under totals. Now, there's a more rational way of doing it. Dave, could I have the previous view foil up again? Okay, now, right now, if I want to send a message over computer mail, I hook up directly to a large distant computer. And the communication costs kill me when I do that. The communication costs are about a third of the message, and that's not sending the message back and forth. Virtually all of that is typing the message in. ARPANET almost always runs full duplex, so when you're typing in your 100 words of text, which is 600 characters, every time you type a character, a packet goes out and a packet comes back in at you. And if you had a more rational architecture in which you had a local mini computer instead of the large distant computer and used your normal cheap terminals, you could cut down your communication cost to nearly zero. And that's what I call the more rational architecture. Also, if you have a local mini computer instead of a large general computer located somewhere else, you can productify your product. You can set the thing up so it runs unattended. You just set your software, get most of the bugs out of it, and then put it in some very forgiving user's environment to get more of the bugs out of it. And the system can pretty much stand on its own and deliver messages all day long, and that's going to cut your labor costs substantially. So Dave, could I get the last thing about that? I call that the rational architecture. And when I looked at that, going to a KL, it seems like I could probably implement form for about 40 cents a message right now, and probably for 27 cents a message by 1985. Again, I'm not sure if these costs are realistic or not. I suspect that they are realistic, and that says that sometime in the not-too-distant future,